of dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. I'm now here with John Waters. Let me just get the overlay on. So John has appeared several times. I think this is your fourth appearance on Millennial. And thank you very much for agreeing to appear again. You're always a highly anticipated guest. Would you like to introduce yourself just for the benefit of anyone who doesn't know who you are?
Okay, John Waters.
Crazy losers.
I'm a former journalist, eventually in Irish media. I was a columnist for many years with the Irish Times, which used to be a good newspaper. It's not now, it's a criminal organisation. I've written 10 books. For the last 5 years, I've been on this case of, since the COVID coup, I've been chasing that up. I with another former journalist, I took a legal action in the Irish High Court and went to the Supreme Court, but didn't get anywhere in the end. What surprise, surprise. It took 2.5 years and something like 30 court hours, and they still told us we had no case. So, you know, I don't know how they didn't spot that on day one. You know, it's incredible. But so I have a Substack for the last nearly 4.5 years. JohnWaters.substack.com. John Waters Unchained is what I call it. And I've been doing that stuff. I'm kind of putting together a compilation of some of those pieces and into a book, which I hope will have a certain coherence for publication next year. And it's going to be called The Abolition of Reality, which is kind of what I think has happened. Ultimately, if you want to put it into a sentence or a phrase, they've abolished our reality and they're building a new one around us, and nobody seems to see what's happening apart from a very tiny few.
Of course, Peter Hitchens wrote a book called The Abolition of Britain, and you could have written The Abolition of Ireland, but you've gone for The Abolition of Reality, and that difference interests me. Well, obviously, they have tried to abolish Ireland. The Ireland of the 80s and 90s is off the past now.
Yeah.
But you've said reality. So that's a much bigger and more fundamental thing. Would you like to explain that?
That's a good question. I think in part, although not maybe it's a huge part, but certainly a significant part, is the fact that my audience now is not just Ireland. I mean, for all my working life as a journalist, my audience was Irish predominantly. I was talking about Ireland all the time. Ireland was my subject as well, you know, and my books are all about Ireland in some way or another. And this one will be a little bit, but nothing like as much. But there are some, you see, I think this whole thing was, because this was a global coup, the characteristics of it were not particular necessarily. They were somewhat particular. It was customized to particular cultures in particular ways. But in general, the methodologies were kind of the same right across the spectrum. And for that reason, we're kind of all in this together. And that's the thing I've noticed about my audience. Has become much more international, and people understand that when I say that Ireland is a kind of a petri dish for the world, and that it's emblematic of the overall condition and the overall things we're facing, they get that now, and I think that's kind of also very true. But the book won't actually be what you might call parochial. In that sense, it's very much trying to kind of put this in a language, whereas in some instances the examples I may be using will be Irish. They're probably representative of things that have been happening right across the world in the last, 5 years nearly. We're a month, 6 weeks away from it being 5 years, aren't we, or something like that. So that's kind of, it's a good question, because it has changed my position. I was somebody who was always very slow to go online. The media used to call me a self-confessed Luddite. You know, the way when you actually say something, it becomes like a crime. you say, when you try to describe yourself, it immediately becomes a crime. So I was a self-confessed Luddite, you know. And but I've got into it now the last 4 years on Substack, and I'm also on Twitter, God help us. I mean, I swore off the things I said about Twitter, that I would never, if I ever was seen on Twitter, I would be, you know, and whatever. I mean, it was like the worst thing in the world as far as I'm concerned. And I'm not sure that it still isn't, you know. But I did it as an experiment this year because I ran in one of our elections. We had several elections in Ireland this year. One of them was the European election. And I ran in that as a kind of an experiment, which is kind of complex because, I mean, obviously, you go into election to win, but, I mean, you also go in not having a hope of winning in your own head, you know. And so you're trying to achieve something with that, and or trying to find out, can it do something? And I think the answer is, at the end, no, it can't. So that's kind of, that's what I've ended up doing now, you know. It's been a very interesting kind of journey. But I think now it's flattening out in a strange way. There's a very strange atmosphere at the moment, I find, both in the world and in the, what I call the resistance. You know, the resistance seems to kind of have reached a point where that first surge wave of energy has kind of died out. And, you know, we're kind of waiting for something to recharge us in some way. And I think that's kind of been quite a cunning strategy. The people who are doing this, who are thinking this stuff all up, this is all part of it. That they've kind of worn us down a bit. You know, I feel worn down, not what you call it, but I feel worn down after nearly 5 years of this. You're not supposed to say things like that. You know, I'm told tactical people tell me that. But I kind of like to tell things as I feel them, you know. That's how things generally are.
Yeah. I don't think that people mind that too much. I mean, I've said things like that in the past. I'm really down, I'm depressed, I'm tired, and so on. People don't tend to... It's surprising how much people actually... It's almost like they like it when someone says it.
I think people in general like it. You know. But I find people within the movement are very censorious of you saying things like that. They think letting the side down or something. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
You know... If it's true, you should tell it. I think, you know, the truth will set us free in that as in everything else, you know. Because I do think, but I mean, just because we're down doesn't mean we're going to be down tomorrow. I mean, something happens, something changes. And I kind of do feel that there is a potential. That's another thing we might talk about. You know, are we in the world on the cusp of some kind of positive change? Can you trust anything anymore? You know, I've been talking about that, writing about that quite a lot in recent times. You know, is it actually possible any longer to be optimistic about anything? Or is the whole thing so engineered that we're kind of in this grid that we don't even know we're in it, but we are in it. We're like in a cage and everything is dictated, including the minutiae of our own futures. I don't believe that, by the way. I don't believe they're that clever. They are cunning and sly and all kinds of things, but they're not that clever. And so I feel that we have to hang on to our organic facilities and apparatus and mechanisms, as it were, for apprehending the world. So if otherwise you would be in a situation where you have to look at everything and think about it in two ways, immediately one after the other. One, oh, this looks kind of hopeful. This could do some. Oh, sorry, yeah. Actually, it's all meaningless because they're all puppets and actors. You know.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I can't really do that. My head isn't up to doing that just yet.
Yes, I think you and I are too honest for that.
Is it honesty, Colin? I don't know. Maybe, but it's just that I think that the most important thing in all of this is to retain hope. I don't mean artificially, not in any Pollyanna kind of sense, but that we actually continue to see the possibility, to hold to the possibility that evil will not triumph. And therefore, what we're trying to do is bring the changes to find that code that will allow us to slip through, you know, and to take to pull victory from the jaws of powerlessness in a way.
Yes.
And And so I refused to give up my antennae, my 69 years now life of experience that I use to actually look at people, look at things, look at situations and come to certain conclusions based on that. And, you know, it's very easy to sit in the corner snorting with derision and saying, oh, you know, you learn. Keep up, John, keep up. You know, I just get so bored with that call. Even if it was true, which I don't believe it is, I would still be bored by it.
Yeah, I understand. So I suppose I should ask, you mentioned the time frame of the last 5 years. This is obviously tied to COVID. Would you say that COVID is a historical thing now, or do you think it's still ongoing in the sense that it has changed the world and those changes have not reversed or gone away? Because obviously, I think you and I really first heard about you through the whole COVID thing and all of that. I think that was how we first got in touch. And some people do say that that's old news now. It's 4 years ago. What would you say about this?
I'd say it both things are true. It is old news and it is old hat, and it feels really tedious in some sense. You know, I mean, not just in that sense, but I mean, it's quite nauseating to think back on the summer of 2020 for me. I find if I see a car now with a 2020 number plate, I actually start to retch at some deep level in myself. You know, do you know what I mean? Because there weren't many cars registered that year, and to actually see one is quite an unusual thing in Ireland. Anyway, not unusual, but you know, it's not as common as 2019s or 2021s. So that is all true, but also because on the other hand, the concept COVID goes way beyond simply the scam, the disease, so-called, the pandemic, so-called. It is the word COVID. You know, it's like it was like the introduction, our first chapter of the coup that was basically designed to steal our lives away, to steal our children's lives away, to steal everything from us, to turn us back into slaves, to restore neo-feudalism, to restore serfdom, slavery. So it's not over at all in that sense. I mean, you mightn't use the word, and the word might make you wretch to even think about it. But it's still a factor, and I think it's the beginning chapter. And ultimately, when this comes to an end, I think that circle will be completed. You know, there are lots of other things happening in the middle now in Ireland and elsewhere. You know, the mass invasions of the European and American homelands, the climate threat, the climate change menace, constant menacing that goes on. There are many things going on, the trans nonsense. And again, that's a very weak word. You know, we don't have words for a lot of this stuff. You know, we're struggling all the time to find words that are emphatic enough. And, you know, you kind of have to use profanity quite a lot. You know, I mean, it is okay, I think, in this context, when you're dealing with deep, profound profanity, it is okay to be profane, but I try not to be. And that means you're constantly kind of inarticulate in the face of what's happening. At least I am, and I feel I am. And I think we're still in that era of that unmentionable thing, that wretch making thing. I think we will see more of it. We will hear more of the aspects of their plan that we heard about first back in 2020.
And that was a very interesting thing at the time. I'm sure I've said it 100 times now, but I'll say it again now because it's been a while. The coinciding of COVID with Klaus Schwab appearing, the World Economic Forum becoming a thing in our lives that we were aware of, and the Agenda 2030. And then the xylophone and the ukulele music, the adverts for a utopian world that they were designing for us, the diagrams and the infographics and all that. and sense that something is being designed here that we have absolutely no say in. And if we don't like it, we're still going to have no say in that either. It's being imposed on us. They're injecting the local anesthesia here and there to surmount the resistance or potential resistance. But eventually, and this thing is going to be built around us, like this, the prison cell around us. You can see it. You can see it. They're implementing, if not actual things yet, the ideas, the justifications, the rationale.
That's right. They're planting all the seeds in the minds of people, so that when the time comes, people will think, well, of course we knew this was coming. It's very necessary. Yes, we've been expecting it, you know, and it's not such a big deal, you know. That's what they're constructing. I mean, again, that whole period and that moment really in 20, I suppose it was April really when it really hit me hard. March, yes, but in April when they started saying you have to stay within 2 kilometers of your own house, I mean, that's when I started to get dizzy at the idea that this could be even happening. And the second thing I became dizzy about was the idea that nobody else was getting dizzy about the first thing that was making me dizzy. It was really sensational when I got to that point. And even today, I was just thinking back again, that search for new words to describe, you know, that I'm 69 years old. Like, I've lived on these years and been listening to liberals in particular, lefty liberals who talked about freedom and justice and truth and honesty and equality and blah, blah. And, you know, you're brought up with these things, like in school and in the church, you hear people preaching about values and, you know, kindness and humanity and all of these things. And then one day they're all thrown in the skip and everybody says, oh, yeah, that's all right. Yeah, they needed to do it because, you know, I've got a sore throat. And that's the only solution, is to destroy the world. I mean, it's obvious, really, you know. And that was people like, you know, the people who paraded as kind of like the gurus of modern liberalism in media, in academia, you know, in the artistic world, you know, the poets, the playwrights, you know, they all just took to their beds and said, oh, well, you know, it is a bad, quite a sore throat, you know.
You know? I think this was what was so disturbing about it, was that people who you would have expected, you know, in the 90s, to have been rebelling against something like this, were instead absolutely up for it. I think the epitome of this was probably when the Kaiser Chiefs.
Oh, yeah.
The Pfizer Chiefs. Yeah. When they talked about the vax at their concert.
Yeah, hands up. Yeah. I know, it was shocking. Unbelievable.
Perverse. It's not what you expect of rock stars. You know, you don't think they're going to be the upholders of morality and social mores, but they were.
Well, this is really fascinating because, you know, I started out as a rock music journalist or a music journalist in, you know, Irish music, rock and roll, all that for Hot Press. And, you know, I breathed in that for decades and breathed it out and wrote and met all these guys. And you know, you did an interview with any of these guys, and this is what you got, these values, you know, these values of freedom and truth and decency and, you know, and all this. And then suddenly, where are they? And there were a few. Van Morrison, that's don't take long. Van Morrison, Morrissey, you know, Johnny
Eric Martin. Eric Clapton, I think.
Eric Clapton, yes. Yeah. Actually, when you think about it, some of the greatest, in fairness. So there was something in the whole thing to begin with. I wasn't the only one who picked that up. That was reassuring in a funny kind of way that I wasn't insane.
Well, you see, it's interesting to think of it there. Those people, and then Right Said Fred as well, different sort of genre. But it was people who were already, who were outsiders even within the music scene, who were sort of oddballs, eccentrics or whatever within the scene. They were the ones who ended up rebelling, and everyone else who was a conformist within that scene conformed to the COVID stuff.
That's right. But when you look behind that, you know, when you look at, you know, at the back line, as it were, of all that, you see something else. You see that what the issue is really is that any infrastructural institution or whatever organization, whether it was like a publishing house, a theater, a magazine, a newspaper, they'd all been made in a state of being purchased by before that.
Oh yeah, I've been writing a series of essays about the rise of what I call the rainbow regime, and just before 2020 was when this sort of peaked and everything had a rainbow stamped on it. Like every band had done a concert at that benefit thing, every record label was they were all voicing allegiance to diversity and sexual freedom and so forth. Yeah. Every single one of them. And it all peaked just before COVID. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's very interesting. And I think that's very important. That's something I would absolutely say, that the LGBT thing was central to the whole bringing about of this situation, because they had functioned in Ireland, for example. We had a referendum in 2015, the so-called marriage referendum, which wasn't about creating gay marriage. That would have been a different proposition. What it was about was essentially demolishing the definition of marriage that existed in the Constitution and replacing it with one that was completely absurd, because it was completely, you know, nonsensical, you know, that two men was exactly the same as a man and a woman who were capable of, you know, intrinsic procreation within their relationship. And you see, it's a funny thing, you know, Colin. You know, we talk about these values, say justice, the desire for justice, which is at the heart of rock and roll, I thought, and I was driven by that. But I had found myself over the previous, say, 25 years actually, involved in a battle that I sort of blundered into, which was the battle to do with fatherhood and the treatment of fathers in family law and in the culture generally. And my sense of that was high, very high up in the sense of my priorities. And I went against what had been up to that point being my ideological outlook on life, which was kind of pro-feminist and all that kind of stuff. And I began to see there's something wrong here, something really radically wrong in the thinking of society.
Yeah, and it's not pro-woman, it's anti-male, that kind of realization.
Yes, I realize now, actually, just to kind of fill in the end before I just make the point more strongly, is that this was all set up in the beginning. This was an attack on family through fatherhood. It was an attack on the natural normative family, let's say, and on parenthood, and on, marriage, and all of these things. That was deliberately part of it. And I kind of had begun to sense that, but I hadn't really got it. And one of the things that, you know, that was what brought me into opposition to the gay marriage thing, because I saw what they were doing in a certain sense. And the way I felt it most strongly was a sense of injustice, that after 20-odd years of making this argument about fatherhood and being ignored by these creeps of politicians, they were now jumping onto hoops to deliver to this other tiny minority, parental rights, family rights, marriage rights, that natural fathers, and there is no other kind, by the way, really, couldn't get. We're being told, no, you're a criminal. You're basically treated like a criminal in family law cases as a father. And so that was a kind of, you know, a touchstone for me. It sort of, when I saw the LGBT thing, you know, there's two different countervailing forces. One is that sense, there's something wrong here. Then the other sense is, oh, I want to be progressive. I don't want to be a bigot. I don't want to be, you know, and you're fighting within yourself about that. But at the same time, I was kind of sticking to my sense. And then they started to attack me because I wasn't, you know, prepared to take their abuse, because they kind of anticipated that I might have things to say about this. And they got their retaliation in first. And so I got into a big row and I left the Irish Times at that point, because my own colleagues started to attack me on Twitter and so on, and the editor refused to say, hang on, we don't do that in newspapers. The reason we have different columnists is to have different viewpoints, and that's what John is doing. He's expressing his views. That idea was gone. That was gone. I mean, that was the first sign to me that the Irish Times was no longer a newspaper, or whatever it was. So what I'm saying is that there is kind of like a sense that, you know, of a pure note of justice that you kind of pick up in the along the way, and you either trust it or you don't. And I hadn't any choice but to trust it, because I had a daughter and I wanted to make sure she was going to be okay. And I wanted to make sure they weren't going to drive me away from her. And I kept in there. And then I wrote out of that experience about other men and what was going on more generally in my column in the Irish Times. And I had a play. I did a play before she came along even about this. But you see, I knew I was counterculture in that sense. But isn't it a funny thing that back in the 60s, being countercultural was a really good thing? And in the 90s and the 20s, it started to be a really bad thing to be countercultural, because the culture now was settled. And it was the end of culture almost in the Fukuyama sense, you know, the end of culture. This is that we now have the answers to everything. Men are bad. Women are great, gays are better, and men can go to hell. That was the new philosophy. And I said, no, I don't think that's true. Because I'll tell you what, even if, you know, us big grizzly old fellas, you know, are not a particularly attractive proposition for, you know, being progressive darlings, we have little boys, and they're helpless. And you want to kill them too. Well, no. We're not going to let that happen.
Yeah, and well, I mean, that it's a matter of, even if you don't like men, if the culture is poised against masculinity, as I think it has been for a long time, the message you have to send is, well, you need men and you need masculinity, whether you like it or not, whether you find it uncouth or whatever, it doesn't really matter. Society will not function without men. And,
we're fighting that out now. One of the things I felt after a while, a very short time actually, in the COVID period, was that a feeling of familiarity, something was resonating with me in the emotional life of the building, as it were, at the time. And it took a little while for the penny to drop. That it was exactly the kind, the demeanor of the politicians now towards the entire human race, as it were, and they were the representatives of the demons behind them, the puppet demons, puppet masters. But that demeanor, you know, which was really shocking, again, just as shocking as the absence of the liberals and the absence of the rock and rollers, it was that these kind of stupid ass, you know, gobshite politicians who were pure, just, you know, harmless idiots, really, you would call them in an Irishism, were now like breathing fire and showing their fangs, you know. And I mean, where did I see this before? Where I saw it before, Colin, was in the family law system. That it struck me had been a rehearsal for all this. That the scapegoat father was, in fact, the guinea pig in this kind of psychological operation. And once they knew that you could do certain things and get away with them, that there were certain dynamics in the culture that would ensure that the victim, your victim, would not be protected or defended, then it was okay to proceed. And that's what they were essentially doing. They were constructing the same conditions whereby they created this demonology about the outgroup, you know, the refusenik, the anti-vaxxer, you know, the far right, all these kind of constructs were exactly the replicas of the caricature of the man they had created in feminism, and which allowed them therefore to abuse this person with impunity in plain sight.
Yeah, and that definitely happened in COVID with the anti-vaxxers and the COVID deniers and so forth. I mean, that was a hate group that was created. A hate group in the sense that this is the group you're allowed to hate. You're supposed to, you've got to, we want you to hate them.
Yeah, well, that is the way group think works. It works on the out group, you know, mostly. I mean, there's lots of different dynamics within it, but that's the most fundamental. That, you know, these people, you can imagine, like, if it's a boardroom, it can be a nation that you created this group think in. There is this sense that we're all in this room, you know, and around this table, and we're trying to do good for humanity and all that, save lives and all this. And then there's these shadowy figures outside the window. Look, there they are. Look, there they are. They're coming. You know, you're going to have to really work hard to make sure that we get this right and we keep these dangerous people, you know, at bay. And it's a funny thing, Colin, you know, I was reading recently in Ireland, this is in purely an Irish context, there's a very good book that came out this year about the Irish Civil War. It was written by a guy called Arthur Matthews, and it's, the title is ironically is called Walled In by Hate, you know. And it's about, particularly about a man called Kevin O'Higgins, who was assassinated in the middle of the Civil War. He was a senior minister of the government, vice president of the, whatever they called it at the time, the Free State Executive, I think they were called. And he was assassinated, you know, 7 bullets in the street, you know, and a very brave man, but a very kind of, you know, the things he did in a certain sense were the actions of war, you know, military, you know, executions, reprisals, things like that. So he was deeply unpopular. But, you know, it's really, you know, struck me about this, that there's a real parallel between that period of 22-23 in Ireland, the Civil War period, when, like, a lot of people died. It was a very dirty war. And the present, the last period, 21-22-23-24, right? And then another thought called, that at that time, I looked it up, like, you know, to refresh myself. Something was just over 2,000 people were killed in that war, you know, on the entire island of Ireland, in that, in about roughly 18 months to 2 years period. And of course, those deaths would have been divided kind of more or less equally, I think, probably a preponderance of Republicans as against Free State murders, let's call them, what there were, to be honest. Now, in this civil war, if you can call it that, where you have the state forces lined up against the people, you know, the political class, the judicial class, the policing class, the media class, the scientific class, the medical class, all lined up against the people and intent clearly upon killing them, or as many of them as they can get away with, in, as it were, you know, a sense of, oh no, that didn't happen. What? No, that's not happening. No, did you see that? No. You know, that kind of vibe. But then it occurred to me, this really kind of devastating thought about it, which is so clear, that all those deaths were inflicted by one side, all of them. Not one of them, even though they go on about the far right and all this sort of stuff, that we're this demonic force in the world. Not one of the deaths was caused by that other side. It's a quite staggering thing. And there were something like 10 times as many deaths in Ireland in that period as there were during the Civil War.
What do you mean that the other side? I'm not following.
Okay, well, if you want to put it into apply the analogy of the Civil War, right? So you have, in Ireland, you had, the split was about the treaty, right? Which was between the Britain and Ireland. And it resulted in the division of the country and the partition and so on. And there were these different forces. So there had been up to that point a monolithic Republican force pitted against the British Empire, right? And then the treaty caused that to split into two sides. The new government, the Free State, it was called, Free State Government. And then the Republicans, who were basically the guys under De Valera, who just were outside, cast outside. They were the post-1916. So there was that. But in fact, both sides had been the same side the day before yesterday, as it were. You know? And so the sides were the Free State versus the Republicans. But like for example, Kevin O'Higgins, the guy I told you about, well, he had executed 4 men who were involved in an insurrection which took over the four courts in Dublin at one point and had a siege there. And eventually they were arrested and brought to prison. And a member of the government, quite disconnectedly, insofar as anything was assassinated by the Republicans. And the government just basically took these four guys out and, arbitrarily and shot them as a reprisal. And Kevin O'Higgins signed off on that, that execution in advance. He gave his acquiescence as his, as vice president of the executive, even though one of the four men had been his best man just a year before. Now, that's the situation. Now, here we are a year later. Okay, the sides are what? Well, the sides are, you know, the government, the state, the judiciary, the police, the medical establishment, all of the powers of the state and of its infrastructure, against a small number of people who say no. There is an analogy there. And what I'm saying is that in the first civil war, as it were, you know, both sides were doing dirty work. In this side, one side is constantly accusing the other of doing, well, both sides are to some extent accusing the other of doing dirty work. But only one side is actually doing this. Only one side is responsible for bloodshed.
This was part of the how infuriating it was, because the sheer asymmetry, you know, we are a bunch of dissidents with no money, no connections, no organizations or institutions, versus a Goliath. And it's very much one single unified, as much as it's composed of different things. It was astonishing how unified it all was. I mean, it functioned so harmoniously against us and against anyone who disagreed with the consensus. That was an astonishing aspect of it all.
Astonishing. It's so, you know, it renders one inarticulate in the face of it, because you have been brought up, as it were, in the culture to see, like, the underdog was always, you know, somebody who was, you know, supported by the culture, by, you know, fringe media, by alternative, by civil libertarians, by civil liberties groups, you know, but they all went to the one side in this whole thing, and they went to the side of power and money. They were all getting grants and subventions and so on from the state. And so they suddenly just started to lie about everything. And they implacably lied through the whole thing, and they're still lying. I mean, it struck me there recently that, you know, up to now, I would have been thinking at the back of my mind about what's happened to my former profession, journalism, as somehow aberrational, you know, that they've gone off the track of justice and truth and so on. But the thought occurred to me, this is permanent. Insofar as the media is permanent, this is now a permanent condition. They're never going to go back. It's not like they're going to mend their ways and say, well, one day I have an editorial meeting and say, you know, I think really that we've been behaving rather badly in this whole thing. I think we maybe took the wrong side from the beginning. That's not going to happen. You know, even though 35 years ago, even if this could have happened then, and it couldn't, generally, the whole thing could not have happened then. I'm convinced of that. But that there would be old grey beards in the newsroom at the news conference who would be shaking their heads to all of this and saying, this is ridiculous, we can't do this. And they'd be shouted down maybe for the first 3 days, but then they would win the argument because they were right. That never happened, and it never will happen in the media we now have. I see, you know, senior figures in the Irish media now, and one in particular, who is like a colossus of integrity down through the years. He's a paid liar now. He's a paid liar. It's like what happened in Russia, you know, with some of the great writers. They compromised themselves to the point where they destroyed their legacies and reputations for all time. And people like Gorky, I think, you know, undermined their whole, you know, the quality of their work. And they were great writers. But in Ireland, we have this phrase, they took the soup, you know. They took the bribe. And there's no going back. And because there's no going back, and because the crimes that are being committed are so egregious, they will never stop lying about them. And this is, and again, I think I said this to you last year, Colin, about this, that this is the thing that really boggles my mind, which is that this is a unique crime. It's a first, I think, in all of history, in the sense that all of the power monoliths are all on the same side. And all they have to do is keep saying the same things over and over again, and there's nowhere to go. I mean, who do you call? Like, well, police? You know? Where do you make an application to a judge? Really? Ooh, that's an interesting idea. You know, we tried it. I'm sorry, it doesn't work. Who else? But tell me something. The priests, yeah. Well, you know, a very interesting thing. You know, there's a young man in Ireland here, Enoch Burke, who's been in jail for over 500 days for refusing to call one of his students they. Now they say, oh, no, it's not that, it's not that, it's not that. It's because he's refusing to purge his contempt. Oh, please, please, stop. He's in jail because he refuses to say that black is white, that 2 and 2 is 5. That's why he's in jail. And recently, his family are really excellent people. They're very religious, you know, I would say, you know, evangelical Christian family, very good people. And their mother and their other brothers and his sisters are out on the, you know, with the cameras, you know, chasing all these high flyer, these, you know, politicians and clerics and
well, that's the thing. You have to do it yourself because there is no organization. There is no part of the media that will do stuff for you, which is supposedly the raison d'etre.
But this is a typical. They tackled a bishop there the other day. I saw it was really extraordinary. He came out of a service station or something, and was totally not expecting this, you know. And they set upon him, and he asked him, well, how come he's the spokesman on prison reform? And he recently had to do it. He spoke in Mountjoy Prison about the conditions, and there's some renovations going on there, which mean that some of the prisoners aren't able to go to their religious services as usual or as much. I'm not entirely clear about that aspect. And he spoke very passionately about this. And they asked him, well, how come you've had nothing to say about my son, my brother, Enoch, who's been in jail for the last 500 days? And all he could say was, I don't like being doorstepped. I don't like being doorstepped. I don't like being doorstepped. You know, and this is what the authority figures in Ireland now resort to. They become victims instantly, you see. They're, you know, because it's the far right. You see, that's how the groupthink works. Oh, we're the beleaguered people trying to do decent things, and there you are shouting at us now in the street. You know, it's terrible. Yeah, but our son is in jail for 500. Oh, I don't want to hear. I don't want to hear. I don't want to hear. I'm not going to hear. You know, that's
it's pathetic. It's absolutely disgusting. I don't know what to say about that, but this is part of it. I think the goal there is to make you look like the belligerent. Like you're the one with the power, even, whereas they're just some ordinary person, not a representative of a huge power structure.
That's exactly. Well, you know, that's been very interesting. I've been writing about that in a different context for many years. The way that left-wingers, you see, because naturally left-wing politics, it doesn't work. When they go into power, they always, the genocide occurs, right? But they're better off, they're better to be in opposition, and they're happier in opposition. But what the trick was for years was they would go into government and pretend to be still in opposition. You know, they would still act like they're the beleaguered, you know, victims of everything, you know. And that's the trick they're doing now. You see, you have these whiny people now. And I mean, that was one of the striking things when I read that book by Arthur Matthews. Arthur Matthews, by the way, is one of the co-creators of, with Graham Lenehan, of Father Ted. People would remember, like, he's a brilliant writer and a really, really smart guy. And the book is really beautiful and excellent, I believe. I was thinking about that in the context of the Civil War, that the personalities of the people that comes out of that book, you know, the rhetoric, the way they speak, the sincerity of it, and the intensity of their feelings about their country, and the way that, for example, you know, Kevin O'Higgins, even when he had, like, in effect, ordered the execution of his best man, he said, yes, it was a terrible decision and a terrible thing happened. It was a terrible thing that was done. But he says it was necessary in the circumstances in which we find ourselves. Now, that's, you know, that's arguable, of course. But my point is that he's not in there weaselly trying to kind of justify himself on the basis that, you know, poor him, he's been... He just say, no, I've made a decision, it's happened, that's it, I'm going to live with my decision and I will live with the consequences. And he did. And, you know, when he was assassinated, when he was riddled with bullets in the street, the men, they came up to him and they were going to finish him off. He took 5 hours to die in his own house. They brought him in. But they were going to finish him off right then. But he spoke to them. He could still speak. And they so convinced them. He could so convince them that they didn't finish. They went away. And they said he knew who we were. But when he was asked on his deathbed to name the men who had killed him, he refused to. He said he didn't know them. You know, so these were men of extraordinary caliber in a way that I don't think we can imagine, Colin, anymore, because they were prepared to die for their country and they were prepared to kill for their country. Now, you can criticize that from all kinds of angles, but you can't match it. You know, that's the point. Yeah. And we can't match it in the present time at all. And the people, the sniveling wretches that are leading us, so-called, God help us, you know, they're not capable of shining the shoes of men like that.
Yeah, I agree. It's something that's very humbling when you realize how much more brave and willing to risk themselves, their lives, willing to risk everything our ancestors were.
Yes.
In any sort of dissident politics, but also just in life in general. I mean, life was so much harsher 100 years ago than it is now. I think we're all pampered.
I think it's kind of as simple, really, as that it's almost a cliche. It is a cliche in a way, that they were so kind of lacking in material things, relatively. Some more than others, obviously. And if you're a politician, you had probably, you know, a decent enough life. And he did. He lived in a nice place and so on. And had a nice family and so on. But at the same time, material things were less important. And what was important, they were very strong religious believers. They beloved their country in different ways, obviously different sides, but of a different view. And there were enemies in their love of their country. But they loved their country equally intensely. And they were convinced that what they were doing was right. And they were happy. I mean, this is one of the characteristics, again, in Matthew's book. Again, and it's not the first time, but he does it very well in these use of the record, describing the demeanor of these men as they went to their deaths, you know, before a firing squad. Like, they weren't whimpering or crying. They were walking, you know, confidently. They were shaking hands with the execution squad. They were wishing them well. You know, I remember there was a guy, Sean McBride. He was in 1916 Rising, and he had been in the Boer War. And the British were been looking for him for years, you know. And he actually only happened to be walking down the street in Stephen's Green on the day of the Rising Easter Monday. And somebody recognized him and said, "Hey, you, Mr. McBride, it's happening. And he ran and became involved. And of course, the British government were delighted to find him in the end. And they've lined him up to be shot. And he said to the firing squad, he says, you know, sleep well tonight. I will. So, you know, and tell everybody that nobody cried. That was his last word. Tell them nobody cried. This is extraordinary. But look at where we are now with the shits that we have to deal with.
Well, that's the thing. See, I don't believe really that they have that same strength of conviction at all. I don't really think that, like, if you look at someone like Justin Trudeau, I don't think that he would die for anything. I think he would run off effeminately screaming at any sort of danger or hazard, because I don't think he actually believes in anything except his own safety, his own betterment, something. I mean, you don't want to pick too much on Justin Trudeau, but really any politician, I think they're attached to material betterment for themselves, but really not nothing else, actually.
Yeah, there was a funny one recently about it. You know, here in Ireland, there's a particular politician, a terrible creep, Roderick O'Gorman. He's a Green Party leader, but I don't think he's going to be back in government because they've only got one seat. He's leading a party now, of which he's the only member, you know. But he was involved in a bit of a fracas in the street because he was much hated, like Kevin O'Higgins, but for entirely different reasons. He had a folder or something in his hand, and it got knocked out of his hand. And this suddenly was turned into like a federal incident. The minister's folder was ripped from his hands. Oh my God, it was the headlines in all the newspapers. Oh, this is the worst thing that ever happened in the history of Ireland, you know? It is literally like he'd been the one who got the 7 bullets or whatever it was that Kevin O'Higgins got, you know, from listening to these creeps, the way they were whining and complaining about this terrible attack, when it was all it was people, you know, who had been battered by the police on behalf of the government, you know, remonstrating with the person who was responsible for it.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And who else are they supposed to? I mean, there is no one else that they can remonstrate with. We supposedly live in a democracy.
Yes.
So your politician is the person that. So who else? Who else is there to go to complain about this? What do they expect?
But now, you see, you've put your finger on it. Democracy. You see, now what's happened here? Like, clearly democracy has been abolished. Clearly it has. But they're not saying that. They're saying that they're democracy. They are democracy. They are the incarnation of democracy. And if you even slight them, you are attacking democracy. You are a domestic terrorist. You are the enemy of democracy. When in fact they have abolished democracy. They did it nearly 5 years ago, one day, in the middle of the night. They did it on a vote which was all rigged in the House of Parliament, the Oireachtas. But that's that. But then the intellectual apparatus of our culture, the media, the writers, the novelists, not one of them has stood up to say this or anything remotely approaching it. They have to know it, but they're not saying it. And so you have this state of normalization, whereby people use words like democracy as if they still had the same meanings that they had 10 years ago, or indeed as if they had some meanings at all, which they really don't anymore.
Is this what you mean when you say the abolition of reality? Because I'm interested in exploring that concept and what you mean by it.
Well, there's lots of different dimensions to it. I mean, that's certainly one. There's the creation of the pseudo-reality that I've described, whereby the media work now really as kind of like stagehands almost. You know, they're doing, it's as if in the night they're out building new sets in the streets so that when we go out in the morning, the world will have changed again, but we won't think it could possibly have changed because they couldn't have built it so quickly. And they describe this new reality. And you find that when you meet people, you know, and they lapse into conversations about things that really are completely irrelevant to the reality of what we face. Or they're about things that happened years ago. Like, you know, example, I mean, like I'll just tell you a slightly funny example. Like, but I remember a few months ago anyway. I was talking to this guy down the country. He was a very, very eminent doctor and very intelligent man. And he had a copy of the Irish Times with him. And I was kind of jocosely saying to him, you're not reading that thing still, are you? It's a criminal operation now. Come on. And he didn't know what I was talking about, you know. And he started sort of asking, what do you mean? And I said, well, I said, you know, what's going on? You know, and he said, what? You know, like, he says, you know. And I was trying, you know, the way you have to be kind of a little bit tentative about it because you don't know what kind of wires you're going to trip with these people. Maybe they've taken the vax and they're vaguely aware there's something wrong and you don't want to alarm them too much. And at the same time, you want to tell them the truth insofar as you can. So I was talking away about him and he's looking at me very puzzled. And I was saying about, you know, the way things are in the country now and it's all da 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 da. And he said, you mean Brexit? Do you know what I mean? Now that's the pseudo reality.
Mm. Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You know, so that's another aspect of what I mean. A third dimension, I mean it, and this is really something which I didn't really, I understood. I figured it out about 3 years ago, and I wrote an essay about it. I didn't actually line it up for inclusion in my book for some reason. And when I thought about it again recently, and it was a book about play. It was an article about play and the function of play in human reality, which is very profound. And the theory was, my theory is and was, is that play was utilized, was weaponized. That instinct was weaponized in the COVID episode in an extraordinary way. So I've gone back to that chapter and rewritten it now. And I think it's actually highly convincing that actually, you know the way that people used to talk about that the religious instinct had been weaponized in the whole COVID thing? You know, and that they had were sort of meeting the appetite for ritual and
ceremony and sinners and
priests. And that was a huge part of it, which I certainly think it was. Well, I actually think that the play instinct is even more profound, like it because it makes animals play, like it's right in the it's in the DNA of virtually every species on the planet. Play. You had to think about the dancing nurses, for example. What was that about, really? That was like as if they were setting a tone that was both signaling that this is both serious and not serious. And also the idea of, well, you know, what distinguishes games? Well, they have rules. And the rules can be quite, you know, sometimes incoherent or like illogical. They don't have to be logical as such. They just are the rules. I mean, you know, when you're playing with your kids, like when you're playing games, whether it's board games at Christmas or whatever, and you have to learn all the rules off by heart. You don't, they're not like things that occur to you spontaneously as rational kind of thing. You have to just say, well, what is the rule? And okay, what does it say on the back of the box? Okay, that's what the rule is. And that's that. Well, that these are the conditions we were asked to meet in the whole COVID period.
And also a game has an objective. So there's a point, something that there's a way to win and there's something that you win by winning.
Yes.
In the case of COVID, it was the prize was that you were a good person. If you played That's the right. game correctly, you've won, you're a good person, as opposed to someone who doesn't play along, who's a bad person.
That's correct. And being good was coterminous with obedience to authority at under every heading. So they got what they wanted by getting you to agree to the game and to play it well. You know, and, you know, I mean, in the beginning, when I did it first, I was kind of thinking about different things about, you know, the way they put the marks on the street, for example, the two figures, you know, the two men, chalk men and 6 foot apart. And it struck me, I came up with this headline at the time, which was like hopscotch for slow learners, you know, like, those kind of ideas were, but I've come across a book, which I'm not going to name now. There is an old book, a brilliant book, which was written in 1938 by, I think a Swiss guy, Johann Huizinga, called Homo Ludens, which is a brilliant, brilliant book about the deep meaning of play in the human spirit and psyche. But I've come across a book more recently, which is much more modern, and it's going to be in my book about this book because I'm convinced now that they read this book. It came out not long before the COVID thing, and it's a really amazing book about video games and so on. And there's so much in it that I think you read it and you think whoever planned COVID read this book, but they've inverted the ideas in the sense that the authors. Sensibility is to see play as a really good thing, a very positive thing in the human nature, and to make the world more playful therefore is a great thing. And but he says, you know, you can take over the world with play, and you can understand that in a benign sense. But then if you flip it, if you're a demonic bastard and you're saying, oh yeah, we could do that, all right, couldn't we? Yeah.
Well, and absolutely. I mean, you can have people banging pots and pans for the NHS, for example, this kind of thing, where they're serving something, they're playing along, they're playing a game, they're doing what's expected of them, they're doing the thing, the ritual.
You're so right. You're so right. That's bang on. And, you know, we had, my wife and myself, very early on, sometime around April in 2020, we had an experience like that on our road. One evening, we're in, you know, it was bright, still bright, and we're passing up our road going home from someplace, from a walk or whatever. And there's a whole gang of people out down the street, like with pots and pans banging them, you know. And they were gathering, they all smiling and waving and looking so fine, as David Bowie said, you know. And we passed them, but we kind of didn't know where to look. So we didn't look anywhere. We just sort of stared straight ahead and kept walking, you know. And one of them said, as just as we passed it, and they didn't even smile. You know, we refused to play the game.
Yeah. And that then automatically there's a divide there, and they know that you're not taking part in their charade, their yeah. game. Yes, you could say yes, and so you're automatically an enemy.
And yeah.
The best that both sides can hope for is no contact at all.
That's right. You know, I don't think we kind of really think about it. You think another thing about the game thing. I mean, somebody was telling me recently about a woman, a mother, the sister of a friend of his who'd had the vax and was now admitting that she was vaccine injured. She knew it. And her children had taken the vax and they might have been. She didn't know. And he said, well, aren't you sorry you took it? And he said, she said, no, we had to take it. We had to take it.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
We had to take it. And I thought, when I heard this, I thought, it's like, you know, where is the place that happens that you actually incur an injury and you don't take it in the same way as if it had occurred in a different situation? On the sports field. If you're on a sports field and you get hurt, it's part of the game. Even if you break a leg, you say, well, you know, he didn't mean it. And it was an accident and it's part of the game. And, you know, I know I'll be fine in 9 months or 9 years or whatever, and it's the same mentality. So somehow they tapped into those kind of feelings.
There are people who are missing limbs because of the vaccine. I mean, it's really it's horrendous.
Yes,
it's so awful. But for them, I guess the rationale I would think is if they tell themselves that they had to do it, then that's infinitely more comfortable than admitting that they had the choice. They did actually have a choice. They could have refused it, but they stupidly didn't, and now they're missing a leg.
Well, you know, you look at what's happening in this context, and it's a little bit subtle at the moment, but it also has that sense that it can renew itself at any time, a little bit like we were saying at the beginning. But there's a sense in which still nobody in charge, despite all the things that we believe or we know have been discovered, the court cases, you know, there was one in Australia, I think there today or yesterday, a very dramatic one about a court finding. But, you know, the Pfizer documents, all those things that came out. In Ireland, none of that mattered. The media just don't report it. Therefore, it didn't happen. So politicians talk about the vaccine in exactly the same way as they talked about it in February or March of 2021. That it's you know, safe and effective, and people should get another. There's another one coming up now, and you know, you should queue up and get it. People are not doing it in the numbers, anything like the numbers, but some people are. Some people are doing it, but the politicians are behaving in a manner that they would want everybody to do it again. So you see, that's at this stage. You see, that's a requisite. That's an essential aspect of the cover up of the crime. They need to be. That's the demeanor they have to persist with. Because otherwise they're admitting guilt.
Yeah, they're opening the door to people saying, "Well, if you don't approve of it now, what changed? And when did you stop approving of it? And why? Or did you realize even then that it wasn't
yes. good
and you were lying even then?
That's right.
So it's better if they just maintain the pretense even now, long after it's relevant.
It's like the rule of the first rule of infidelity, you know, deny, 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 and keep on denying, you know, because the minute you think that you know, well, I'd throw myself on the mercy of the court, you know, that's the moment of your doom, you know, and it's the same thing. And I mean, I know that's a slightly flippant way of interpreting it, but it's that's the
same. No, but the mechanics of it are the same. Yeah. It's a thing that you, it's better if you don't admit to it even long after the fact, because then that opens you up to all sorts of interrogation and retrospective condemnation.
Yes. So the very worst that can happen, you think, or they would think, is that they'll say I was naive or stupid, but that's not as bad as being a murderer.
Yeah, and I think a lot of ordinary people were naive and stupid about it. But the thing is that we rely on our politicians precisely not to be naive or stupid about things.
Yes.
And I think this is, for the likes of you and me, this has been one of the really grim discoveries of the last few years, realizing that ordinary politicians, like run-of-the-mill, common or garden politicians, really are just very mediocre people. There's nothing... They're not sort of pillars. They're not better than ordinary people at all. A lot of them really, I don't think, should be politicians. I mean, for example, the Scottish Parliament, I think a lot of them would just have been local councillors. But then the Scottish Parliament was created. So then they get an inflated position that really is, they're not up to in theory.
Yeah. Again, looking at the Irish situation, and I think it's kind of quite typical in a way of cultures. You know, in times of revolution and strife, you get a very high quality of person ending up in politics. You know, you get poets and writers and philosophers and you know, putting on military uniforms and you know, that sets a kind of a bar for the immediate future, and that actually can continue on a long time into peacetime. But one of the things that's happened in the last century in Ireland and in many other countries, Britain also, you know, is that there was a devolution of power upwards to supranational organizations all over the place, you know, the EU and the UN, and then under the other different categories, WHO, and now the World Economic Forum, you know. Which is, you know, a very interesting anagram. If you turn it backwards, it spells FEW, you know, the few. It represents the few, the rich few in the world. And so what actually happened then was, when you have that power being devolved upwards, the impetus or the motivation for those high caliber people, whether they were poets or philosophers or business people, they were less likely to want to go into politics, because basically you were just a messenger boy carrying out, you know, so they didn't want to do it. So that meant that the standard got down, you know, fell down. The people that were going, that worked its way down through the political systems and their cultures and infrastructures. And what you were getting in then at the front door of politics was a very much relatively low grade, a person, just a kind of an apparatchik, anorak type person, you know.
Yeah, a yes man.
Yeah,
apparatchik, that's the word. You know, I've actually been watching quite a lot of interviews with Dominic Cummings recently. I don't really know why. When I'm working on Millennial, I tend to look for things that can accompany me while I'm working on graphics or whatever. So this year, that was one of the things that I found. And he is actually a very good interviewee. He's very interesting, and he's had an insider view of the British government. Obviously, I disagree with him about COVID. He is a genuine believer that there was a disaster, an impending catastrophe, and all this. He still seems to believe that.
Ah,
but then he's also
remember
aware
what we just
Fauci.
Said. If you were there, you're going to have to keep denying.
Yeah. But he's also acknowledged that Fauci and his team lied a lot. He's acknowledged that. So I don't know, but the thing that is interesting from Dominic Cummings is his reports about the sheer shambolic nature of the British government and the civil service in this day and age. And he reports various things from his experience. He was there for about 3 years, and I can't remember all of them now, but it is the picture he paints is just lamentable that it, and he does make the point that the exact point that you've just made, that the capable people have been drawn elsewhere. The government and civil service has repelled capable people for decades, ever, you know, the Yes Minister stuff, that's 40 years ago now.
Yes.
And then that's exponential. With each successive generation, they promote or only employ people in their own image or lesser.
Yeah.
More malleable, more spineless, less imaginative.
That's right. That's where people like Dominic Cummings come from into politics. That's how they come into it, because they're the spin doctors or the PR people who are going to make these guys seem intelligent or functional, when in fact they're incoherent and stupid beyond belief, most of them. I mean, we see this very clearly with ministers. So there's only one journalist in Ireland, really, in the context of political reportage, as a guy who works for Gripped. .ie, and he buttonholes these guys, you know, and asks them questions, like, which nobody else does anymore. And you can see that after the run out of the three or four lines they've been given by the PR person, that they're completely lost. And he gets to that point very quickly. And you can then see this person exposed as a complete moron. And the Minister for Education is the person's title, for example. And you just say, my God, it's worse than I thought. I couldn't possibly have imagined this. But it is. It's extraordinary the way this facade can pass muster in the pseudo-reality. You know, that people becomes normalized. And it doesn't, nobody kind of remarks anymore. You know, and if you start saying, well, did you see that interview? No, I didn't see that. No, I didn't know that. No, I like that. I think she's a very good minister. Yeah, very good. It's quite surreal. Like, again, I say this, Colin, like, it's like in this, as in so many other things, you have this sense overwhelmingly that suddenly we slipped into reverse gear a few years ago and started to slide backwards. And we're plummeting now towards the Middle Ages at a rate of knots. We're losing everything we had thought we had acquired in terms of civilizational values and understandings and intelligence and so on. And we're plummeting back into the depths of, you know, heading back into the Black Death or something, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's a surreal kind of moment in so many ways. One that I never thought I would live to see. I mean, you couldn't possibly have foreseen this kind of ending, as it were, for one's life. It's a surreal kind of reality, which again brings you back to my title, The Abolition of Reality. Very often, I mean, you know, when you're looking for kind of metaphors or analogies or kind of images to describe reality. I mean, the ones that kind of make the most sense are ones involving aliens or simulations or something like that. That it's like the whole thing is a hoax. You know what I mean? It's like that you know everybody's in on a joke. You know that one of those jokes where people play at parties or whatever. You know, they come in to tell you some yarn, and you know the guy who's part of the party it is, and they tell him some yarn, and he's believing it. And then the next thing, everybody starts howling in laughter, and somebody jumps out from behind the filing cabinet and says, "Ah, I got you going there." You know, and it's kind of like that, isn't it? That you think one day we're going to wake up, and this will all have been a dream.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, there have been times when I've really wished that. Like, at the height of COVID, when life itself, life was so surreal. It was so just weird. Mm-hmm. And I remember wishing, like, looking around and seeing people and just seeing them as zombies and thinking, when are they going to wake up? When is this going to end? Because mm-hmm. they genuinely believe this. Or at least they're behaving as if they genuinely believe it. One thing I would want to add about the incompetence of government, the thing is, and we saw this during COVID, that the politicians might be incompetent, even the civil servants might be incompetent, but it's like the clown with a knife. They might be stupid, but they are still dangerous, because they might be incompetent, but there are clearly systems working under them that can deliver discipline to the public. So they might be making stupid decisions, but they can enforce them very effectively.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that person has served 500 days in jail already. I mean, that's incredible.
Oh, no, I take no consolation from their stupidity, in a sense, you know, because they are dangerous on account of it, because the mindlessness of what they're doing and the reasons they're there for doing it. They're doing it because they're told. It's on the protocol. You know, it's part of what they believe. You know, they've learned off by heart. There are lines, you know, it's in the rules. All these things. So they will blindly push on because they don't have any other option, because they're not capable of thinking of another, of a way out, of an alternative, of even of unpicking the logic that has brought them into this situation. And so they will go on and on. And this is something which is incredible, but history tells us that it's what happens, that insanity takes over. And that then things get really dangerous. You know, I mean, you only have to read the history of any great tyranny, say that's Stalinism, and look at the way that people who were, as again in the Irish Civil War, you know, that same the tinge of, you know, friends suddenly dividing and becoming mortal enemies, and with all the consequences of that, where all humanity is lost, all compassion is lost, all you know, fellow feeling is lost, and we're in the jungle, and that's this close all the time when you start messing around at this level with stuff. And I think that they've done a lot of messing around, like, and you know, it's interesting. You mentioned at the beginning talking about the year in Ireland. We had an election which actually more or less threw up the same result as the election which happened just before the COVID episode started in February 2020. It's almost exactly, the numbers are exactly the same, except the Green Party is now kaput and has been replaced by a different party, which is identical, the Social Democrats, and they'll probably end up in government, or the Labour Party, which again is identical, will end up in government as the tail to wag the dog of the larger parties, because now it takes three parties, used to just two, and before that, actually, one party could govern. So there's a kind of a deterioration, but the extent that we have, you know, you can't disallow the possibility that there has been massive fraud, because, I mean, the Democratic Party of the United States is very much present in Ireland, and they're the world experts in fraud, electoral fraud. So you kind of have to assume there's a bit of that going on. And there was in the European elections, where there was migrants were being bussed in all over the place to vote in elections over there, the local elections. And of course, they were having the odd vote in the European elections as well, even though they're not supposed to, and so on. But okay, parking the question of fraud. And I mean, I say to people, well, if you want to know was there fraud, just ask yourself, look at your local politician and the way he looks at you and the way he speaks to you compared to the way he spoke to you 10 years ago. Does he care whether you vote for him or not? I think not. So he knows something you don't know, okay? So that's the way to think about fraud. But even leaving that aside, if it were there wasn't fraud, then there was complete like stupidity. But on the other hand, the whole pseudo-reality is constructed in such a way that no real viable alternative can find its way into the system to create an opposition that would be in any sense meaningful. It doesn't matter who's elected. It doesn't matter what the government's composition is. It will be the same outcome. We've had the same government now for something like 13, 14 years, essentially. Same, even though they've been booted out numerous times, they still came back in a different form. And that happens everywhere now. It's happened in France. I mean, you've had that creep president of France forever. And he'll be, you know, there for another forever, by the looks of it. And it's the same everywhere. Now, Britain, of course, a different case. But Britain just gets worse and worse. Like, then you got to say that, you know, there's great creativity at the heart of the British
yeah. system. Yeah, but, I mean, after Rishi Sunak, I think a lot of people thought that it couldn't get any worse.
Yeah,
it's happened.
Then it just did. And it's amazing, like, that you think, well, okay, well, what's going to be next? My God, you know, you could worse than this, like, wow, that would be some achievement. You know, you kind of almost look forward to seeing, you know, what kind of, it's like a soap opera. It's horrible. It's really
what will
awful.
They come up with in the sequel?
I politics. I mean, you see, there's a bit of a contradiction. I'm not sure how to express this or how to think it through. you know, there's a big, strong view within the movement, the freedom movement, that politics is dead and it shouldn't be entertained. And, you know, if you run for election, you're kind of playing their game and so on. And I kind of understand that to some extent. But I didn't say, well, yeah, but isn't the problem here that how, you know, how does an opposition get into a position where they can do something? Well, there are three ways, I say, and they all begin with V. There's a violent insurrection, Velvet Revolution, as in Czechoslovakia in 1989, and voting. Now, if you say voting doesn't work, and I'm not going to disagree because, you know, it doesn't seem to at the moment anyway, but I would have thought, by the way, that eventually, if we win, it will be one of the part of that would be winning an election of some kind. But, you know, at some point, at some stage. But if you're saying, no, that's completely useless, okay, which of the other two options are you now proposing? And how do you say we should go about it? And nobody has any answers to that at the moment.
Yeah. I think that's to do with what something I was saying with Greg earlier, is that it's the type of people who are involved in something dictate what will happen in that thing. And you know, that's a banal statement, but it needs to be stated. And people like you and me are probably not the types who will seize politics, political power, whatever. We're not that type of person. But so it needs that changeover. Not changeover, let's not do ourselves down. it needs that injection of those types of people.
It does,
organizers,
yeah.
Organizers, doers, etc.
That's right. People who people with pretty high boredom thresholds, you know, I mean, who don't get, you know, distracted into other things. You know, like I have this sense that it probably is true in every country, that when these traumas descend on a population, that it takes a very long time for the kind of people who might be suitable to even approach the political sphere. And I think for that reason that in Ireland and maybe elsewhere, you know, the future leaders are nowhere near that yet. They're still out there, unrecognizable. You see them in the street, you pass them in the street, but, you know, they haven't declared themselves yet. They won't be the people who, you know, were at the front line by and large. That doesn't seem to work very well, you know, for very long. I don't know why that is. But there's also problems, I think, with the resistance movement in lots of different other ways, and certainly in Ireland, whereby there's a lot of infighting, a lot of kind of, you know, lack of cooperation. In the context of, say, vote transfers, we have a proportional representation system, and it would be, you know, quite easy to manage votes in a better way. And that's not happening. And a lot of kind of backstabbing and so on. And I think somehow that bespeaks a kind of frustration at how successful actually the campaign of the regime has been in wearing down the opposition and demonizing the opposition and making them pretty much impotent and marginal. And so you're kind of waiting for a moment that never seems to get any nearer. And that is the awakening, the consciousness exploding into realization. And we're nowhere near, I don't know if we're any nearer than that than we were in May of 2020, to be honest with you. That's, again, a bit negative maybe, but that's how I see it sometimes.
Okay. Let's move on to the super chats, because there are quite a few, and I don't want to go too much over our time limit. Okay, Pat said, in your view, did you two turn sometime during their career, or were they always servants of the powers that rule the world today? Or perhaps better formulated, did they sell their soul sometime during their career, or did they never have any in the first place?
Oh, I think they definitely did have a soul at one point. And I think something entered in, for sure. I wrote a book about U2 in Ireland, and U2 and Ireland, over 30 years ago, actually. And so I got to know Bono and Edge and Adam. I interviewed those guys, and I got quite, you know, up close. And I fundamentally, at that point, that would be like early 80s, fundamentally believed in them. And I believed that, in fact, my book was called Race of Angels. And one of the core things was actually about essentially what we would now call corporatocracy. That I saw that there were, that the force that they were sort of pitted against in their own imagination was really this. And that they were genuine about it, you know, that they wanted to take on the material world and offer a more spiritual view of reality and so on, and that that was sincere. But something did happen, and I can't say what I know. You could say they turned, or were turned. I mean, to be hanging around with George Soros like he's not a good idea. And they certainly have, and you can see it in their appearances and their. You know, Bono looks so broken now, you know, his face looks so cracked and fearful. And he was a real idealist, you know, he really was. And I remember talking to him about all this stuff early on, like, and he was really switched on to an awful lot of things. And he's a really very, very intelligent guy, very funny guy, much nicer guy than people think, you know. I mean, he's possibly better, nicer than he comes across on stage, because he does swagger a bit, but that's the gig, isn't it? You swagger. But I think my sense is that they were got at. I think they were possibly, now this is a theory, it's speculative, that because they just wanted to stay on top and they were slipping, in the middle, coming, there was an album they did which is Pop, which was very good in lots of ways. They had lots of good tracks on it, but it was diffuse and it had no unity. And it wasn't as successful as the previous album. And it looked like they were going to slip. And then suddenly they just kind of realigned and sort of created something, not new, but a kind of a rinsed down version of themselves that was still good enough for their fans. And they held that together then for another, whatever, 30 years. And they have done. But it, to me, there's really no great album in between. Like, the last great album they made was Akpom Baby, which I think was 1991. So the middle of the 90s, sorry, the middle of the 90s, not the 80s.
Pop was 1997, I just checked.
Pop. Yeah, 97, right? So for, then they produced what I would regard as a couple of very mediocre albums, which are actually commercially very successful, which is interesting. So I think that at that point, that they were persuaded, perhaps, that they needed to pledge their fame and their achievement and their reputations and their influence to other causes. And I think that, now I don't know what shape that would take in, and I don't have any hard evidence other than circumstantial. But I do believe that their intentions were good. And I think they still, this is probably naive, but I think that that spark is still in them. I actually look at Bono now, and I think this man is heartbroken.
All right. I mean, obviously, there's a lot to be said there, but I want to stick with the super chats. I think it might be worth you doing a stream about that, because it sounds like you would have a lot to say about it. Okay, Thomas says, thank you. Black Pigeon Pilled, does Ireland have bovier added to its cattle feed? I'm told by friends it's a way of getting mRNA into the population for those who refuse the vax. Merry Christmas, Woes and Waters. Do you know about this I don't know how it's pronounced, bovier?
Yeah, I'm beginning to hear about it. I don't know a lot about it, to be honest, Colin. I've heard that it's in milk in some shops, some supermarket chains are putting it into their milk, and that we need to check it. It's on the, apparently it's on the cartons and so on, if it's there. I think it's very ominous. I do think they have been looking for other ways of getting the mRNA into people, who are no longer taking vaccines or were refusing all along to take vaccines. I mean, and that's something we're going to have to really find a way to deal with. And I mean, obviously, that means at one point we're going to have to reclaim our democracy and restore, you know, morality and order and decency to the institutions that are dealing with these things. But I don't know enough about the situation to make any comment about whether it's in cattle feed. I haven't heard anything specific on that score, but I don't put it past them, and I certainly think it's something we need to be alert about.
Yeah. All right. And then the NREB says it's a face crime not to smile at COVID pot bangers. Right. Yeah. Well, for a while it seemed that it almost was that. That might be specific to Britain. I don't know, because of the NHS. But I imagine similar things happened in other countries.
Yeah, it is a face crime. It is. That's right. And it's an amazing thing. Like, you know, you kind of know when it's happening. I think
I remember the first time it happened, but I was aware of it, and I heard this noise outside, and I think it was a Thursday night or a Tuesday night, I can't remember, like 9 o'clock or something, and I remember hearing this noise and thinking, what the hell is that? And I went to the window and realized this was what was happening, and it was an ominous moment, because it was like, okay, everyone else is brainwashed. Everyone else is doing this thing, taking part in this this nonsense, this charade, this ritual.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
But it was, and it was, you know, that play thing. It is literally. I mean, it's you know, it's like toys. People playing with their toys in the streets. You know. It's a remarkable. You know, the coherence of that idea, I think, is. You know, the more you talk about it, the more you think about it, the more you kind of exchange ideas about it, the more real it becomes.
Yeah, with the moral reward that you're a good person.
Yes.
That's really sick. Okay, Monty Fontaine, after witnessing how the media lied and exaggerated about COVID, are there any other historical plagues which you question? Or do you think there was less interest from big pharma conspiratorial agents back then? Personally, I'm a little sceptical of the Spanish flu. Thanks, Chad.
There are
conspiracy I don't know if there are even theories about that. You take it.
Yeah, I've heard all those stories and theories and, you know, about hypotheses about the Spanish flu and pneumonia, and as opposed to, you know, any kind of virus and so on. And I think there's certain plausibility in that. I just don't know. I tend to think that to some extent the kind of relative primitiveness of the world was protecting the human race from the kind of things we're suffering now. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, Ireland kind of, when I was growing up, Ireland was you know, a very poor place, but actually a great fun place to live. And a very nice place to live, even though the media worked very hard to demonize the past. And in a sense, that the greatest disaster that happened to us when we were was becoming rich. You know, of course, it's entirely false, the richness. It's a multinational corporation economy functioning, cuckoo in the nest economy, using Ireland as its base and turning the entire island into an entirely different place to suit themselves. But, you know, we get nostalgic. I get nostalgic then for a time when nobody wanted to come here, when nobody wanted to know anything. It was a really boring, stupid place, you know. And, you know, I mean, I remember we used to get really upset when, you know, a famous rock band would have a world tour and they wouldn't come to Dublin, you know. We'd be really outraged. But now we really want them not to come to Dublin, you know. We really wish you stay away. Stay away, don't come, you know. We want the corporations to come. There's this guy, Lutnick, who's taking over. President Trump's new commerce secretary, and he's been threatening to pull the plug on the Irish transnational tax dodgy economy. And I really hope, and I tweeted out about it recently, you know, let's hope he's not bluffing, you know. And I got a huge positive response. Like, huge numbers of people out there think the same thing. They think the only hope Ireland now has is if it is completely destroyed economically. That's the only thing that will save it from absolute obliteration.
Yeah, yeah. It's a fairly common syndrome where wealth is a curse where, you know, for a country. You know, that it ends up... You pray for the old days. You pray for the simplicity of when we weren't that rich, when things were more innocent and less corrupted and less commercial and less meaningless.
Yeah. And you weren't attracting envious glances or, you know, from outside. You're saying, oh, we'd like a bit of that, you know. We could do that, you know, we could use that place, you know, we could, you know, dupe those people easily, you know, we could steal their country from under them. They didn't think of that, but they didn't bother. And so we just sort of muddled along in our own way, and it was fine. We were absolutely fine. We, you know, nobody was dying of starvation. You know, we were muddling. We weren't rich. You know, we had old cars and stuff, you know, but we were happy.
Yeah. I mean, Scotland was similar. You know, I often get nostalgic when I look at photos of Edinburgh in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and I realise, bloody hell, it really has changed. As a whole thing, Edinburgh in the 80s had, you know, patches of waste ground where something had been, but there wasn't now. Whereas nowadays, it's all, you know, building everywhere.
Yes.
And I don't like it. I preferred the dilapidation. There's something about me that I just preferred. It's got so much more character and personality, and it feels like a place, a home,
rather than just an outlet of globalism. All those buildings that we used to love, which we loved, we didn't realize we loved them, but we passed them and they were just there, and we just like, and now they're demolishing them and building these mass ugly tower blocks, and for people who are, you know, for what, like, well, to build an entirely different country on the site of the old one.
Yes, that is ultimately what it amounts to. Okay, and then Yelda says, Merry Christmas, lads. Thank you very much, Yelda.
Thank you.
Open Borders said, is John related to Roger Waters? I imagine this is a question you get quite regularly.
Now and again, yeah. No, I don't think we're related. I don't know. Possibly way back. Who knows? We're you know, a lot of Waters is in certain parts of Ireland. Very rare, unusual name, but in some places where it is, where it does exist, it's very common. But Sligo, my father came from Sligo. There's lots. Every second person you meet there is called Waters. I don't know. When I was a teenager and growing up, I used to always refer to Roger Waters as Cousin Roger, you know, just to kind of wind people up. But I never really believed it, you know. But
okay.
So no, probably not.
All right. And Privileged Shitlord said, give us back the bad roads. He's talking about the loss of wealth and how that would be nice again.
Yeah, that's my book. That was my last book, Give Us Back the Bad Roads, which is like, again, like a cry for...
I see. I didn't know that. My apologies.
When Ireland had bad roads, we were happy. Since we got the motorways, we've been miserable.
Right. Someone else said that to me, that Ireland used to, it was just country roads and they're very up and down, and there weren't many motorways at all.
And those roads are still there, Colin. This is an amazing thing. If you know where to go, you can drive from, say, you know, in the old days, you can still go on the old route from Dublin to, say, where I come from, down the west, pretty much on those old, windy, narrow roads. And it's so beautiful on a summer's day to go do that, you know. I really recommend to people, because you find that you go to all those old villages and they've got little cafes now and places you can stop off and have a sandwich and something. And you know, it's very heartbreaking, of course, now, because you know you're in the past. You're in something that isn't of the modern Ireland. But it's still there, you know, to be enjoyed in its own way. So, again, they've abolished reality, but it's still there as well, if you can find it.
Yes. Then one more. The Celt Denise says, Mr. Waters is wonderful. Thank you very much, Denise. And I get an armchair Limerick nationalist asks, do you think that Trump or Kennedy will start a real inquiry into the government rollout of the COVID vaccine, given Kennedy's views?
Well, obviously, I don't know, but I have a sense, a feeling and a hope that something like that will happen. I mean, I'm aware of Trump's ambivalence or apparent ambivalence on this question in relation to the Operation Warp Speed and the beautiful vaccines and all that. But I don't attribute that to any definitive value. I think that that may be smokescreen. There's a hope it is. And I certainly don't think he would have appointed Kennedy if he intended to continue that line or its logic. So I do believe that, see, we're back to this question then as well. Can Trump be taken at face value? Can he be taken at his word? I believe so, because the man is now 76 years of age. Like, if he's not going to do the right thing now, he's never going to do it. But why not? Like, you know, I think that this is a real danger that we're painting ourselves into a corner of believing that nothing is possible, that not much is possible anymore, that the world is too tightly bound in the grids, the power, the control grids, and so on. I don't believe that. I believe it's a question of our capacity to hope. And the problem is that that idea itself kills hope. So I think we should abandon that idea, even if in the abandoning of it, we are being, as it were, naive and a little bit sort of gawky and stupid. I say, let's be that. Let's be naive. And let's pretend we can take our countries and our world back from these bastards. And then, you know, there's a better chance of doing it in that frame of mind than in the other one.
Yes, yes, I completely agree. I completely agree. Well, on that nice note, let's wrap this one up. This has been a very interesting conversation, so thank you very much for doing this again. I know that people have been putting in lots of nice complimentary comments about this. I think they always love to hear from you, so thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I'll be back very soon with the next one, which I think is New Right Post. Let me just make sure of that. Yes, it is. Well, it's difficult to remember sometimes.
It's Friday, so it must be New Right Post. Right?
And I'll see you then. In the meantime, John Waters, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Getting on the line.
Happy Christmas, everybody.
Okay. See you all later.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Get the info you need at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.